Mark, thank you for that very gracious and undeserved introduction. Of course, it's a great, I'm very happy and honoured to be back in Cambridge. I need to say a few things about this lecture before I begin formally, and one of them is that I'm going to be trying to talk about the relationship between orality and literacy in India, and also I will draw a very large arc from prehistory to the present times, because as you know, I teach in the Technology Institute, and I have several dots there, but you're going to all have to help me to connect them. So I'll try to do my best to begin, because I've lots, you know, I'm Indian, and thousands of things crowd into my mind every time I want to speak. So I'm going to try to cram them all in within the next 45 minutes or so. So thank you very much, Mark. And the other thing I wanted to say was that Mark is working on a very important project, and a project which has many, could have major consequences, because he's talking about the loss of the world's languages. But today my theme is going to be somewhat different, in the sense that I'm going to be talking about the way in which languages and cultures contain within themselves the resources to regenerate, to rejuvenate, and even to reincarnate, if you like, across time and space. So it is not so much about endangerment as about resistance to extinction. My theme is as much about that as about extinction. So with that, I get into the formalities of this topic. So there are lots of things, scripts and boxes and orality and narrative, all of which I have to try to put together. So, you know, as Mark said, I write books. And I can tell you, and I sometimes even write articles, but, you know, none of them add up, I would say, with absolute confidence about myself, that I'm the queen of unreadability, and I am absolutely certain that at least as far as my books are concerned, and many people in this room write books, none of them measure up even remotely to the enchantments which the covered, of which I have a bonsai version. About which our bonsai versions here have to offer. So we're going to be talking not about that stuff, but about this really important stuff. So my talk is in three sections. The first one goes back to prehistory, to the evolution of speech and script, and of course many of you will already know about this, so I will just add my bits to it. The second is about the coward, and the third part is about linking up the development of narratives and orality in history as well as prehistory to present day developments in IT and all that sort of stuff in India, and what we can do with digitization and prayer for digitization and preservation. Can you hear me back there? Okay. So, the evolution of speech and script. So I just want to put, everybody knows these things, so I'm just reminding you that if you look at this, and I have lots of references, so I'm happy to give them, share them with you. You know, if you estimate, and people have said these are just so stories because you can't really know when speech evolved, but insofar as people do calculations, it took a long time to put the hardware for speech, for speaking into being. And my first book was actually called The Hyoid Bone, and it was in all the dentistry sections, because this is something to which the muscles of the tongue are tied. It's dear. So all these things developed, you know, over 100,000 100,000 to 200,000 years. And then there was something which is now being called the social explosion in language, which was that human beings kind of discovered each other socially, began to talk to each other, and I'm going to talk about some of this social explosion. And writing came. This is the estimate, only 5,000 to 7,000 years ago. So it's very late. It's a late invention. So linguists standardly say if the evolution of language is counted as one day, writing came at the 11th hour. And yet it's very, very dominant. I sometimes say it's like America, you know, alarmingly young but very powerful. Why was script such a late comer? We know that it's possible, I've written about this elsewhere in terms of gender, that you can stir a pot, hold a baby, and talk. But damned if you can do that for when you're writing. For writing, you need concentration, you need silence, you cannot do hold the baby, which is screaming in your ear, and so on and so forth. So writing inevitably meant settled agrarian society, setting aside time for writing, and of course this led to forms of hierarchy, gender dominance, and so on. I won't go into the biology of this, or the linguistics, but I could in language acquisition. So, because we're in Cambridge, I thought I'll make a connection with Cambridge. So I read about this last year, and this article was about what was called prehistoric preschoolers, and you see these finger flutings on the wall. Okay, so these archaeologists at Cambridge argued that they could tell the age and gender of the children who had made these finger flutings on the wall. That is, they could identify individuals, and they could identify individual children by matching up the marks again and again. And the person who was talking about this, who was called, I think, Jess Cooney, says that they could make out that the children were around five, that the child was a girl, and the parents, enthusiastic parents, were lifting them up to draw on the walls of the cave. So, very enthusiastic parents. And Jess Cooney said, it's important to realize that children played a major role not only in the development of art, but I would maintain in the development of writing, pre-writing, and also they played a part of what it means to be human. So I want this to be one of the themes, because I think that when we think cross-culturally, we need to think also not just about, you know, separate languages, but also the question of what it means to be Indian and what it means to be human, and so on and so forth. So I want to interpret this Cambridge insight in terms of, you know, some people will recognize this painting. It's by Jamini Roy, who said, a Bengal artist, who said that he learned from his son, his five-year-old son, to draw the eyes of the child outside the mother's face, because this was the child's perception, and he became a famous artist on the basis of the child's perception. Now, how are we to relate this to narrative? I want to take a figure, and this is Krishna here in his incarnation as Ram, and this is Ram, this is Sita, who you can see is much bigger. Anyway, so this is Krishna, whom we're going to be talking about, the god Krishna. And Krishna is seen as a very young child in the Indians in this room may be familiar with these. So the first thing I want to talk about is, how do we understand speech in terms of what it means to be human? And here's the story. So Yashoda asks her son Krishna to open his mouth because she suspects that he's eating mud, which we would today call pica. And when he opens his mouth, she sees the whole universe in his mouth. She sees herself reflected in his mouth. And so this is telling us something about speech, the child, and what you see about the representation of who we are in these narratives. And these are oral narratives. I mean, I never read a written version of this, but I heard it from my grandmother. And Krishna tells a lie as well. So he says, Maya mene makan kayo. I did not eat the butter, which he, of course, stole and ate. So he's lying. He is also very powerful because you can see the universe in his mouth. He also tells lies, so not an entirely moral being. And he has a flute, which is represented like this, and that is marks, to my mind, can be read as intonation patterns. Those of you who've read Darwin will know that he thought human speech was related to song, because intonation patterns may have been prior to the development of syllabic structures. I'm a linguist, but I try not to complicate this. What I'm trying to say is that these myths and legends, these oral narratives which have been handed down, hold in themselves lots of resources for understanding ourselves, not only as Indians, but also as human beings. And I'll come back to this theme later. So, I've already said this, every human child has heard true stories, myths and legends, or told its first lie by the age of 4. And when we listen to a narrative, and it's a good narrative, children, you can measure this. If you're stuck up to the galvanometer, your palms will sweat, your pulse rate will go up, and you know it's false. You know, it's not true. So we know that we have narratives in every known human culture. But many people would say, well, narratives are not an efficient way of conveying information. So why is it that you have them in every known culture? Why do our palms sweat and so on? So in one of my early books, in Narrative Gravity, I tried to attack this question, and recently it's got a lot of attention, this thesis. So I asked this question, and I answered that narratives are relatively inexpensive means, but like flight simulators, of teaching us about what we should do in situations of cultural danger or survival. So you don't actually have to climb a cliff or fall in love. You learn about these things fairly cheaply, because imagine if the species was really climbing cliffs to understand danger, you would be an extinct species very soon. So language gives us these means, the actual physical stimulus, to try and understand what it means to be other and what it means also to be in situations of cultural survival. That was my thesis. Mm-hmm. Now people are testing it, and with very interesting results. So narratives are a very old language genre that perennially seek to address the question, what does it mean to be human? I won't go into the technicalities, but in general, narratives are embedded in oral conversations as we learn them. And in my work, what I've found, looking at ordinary everyday narratives, and many linguists have found this, there is half the work is done by the listener. So the listener is filling in the evaluation, the listener is filling in the, because these are heard stories, they're already there in the culture. So this is very interactive, very intersubjective, and therefore also an important genre to learn, to get cultural knowledge. So Dan Dennett says this. He says human beings are wired to tell stories as naturally as birds build nests and beavers build dams. So, you know, this, we need narratives to spin our cognitive environments. That's the idea, and this is why I think orality is very basic. And I've argued quite recently that if we look at the structures of narrative, you look at conversation, and that has an A, B, A, B, A, B, I speak, you speak, and so on. You look at narrative, and it has a linear recursive, what we call a recursive, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, D, E, G, F, E, you know, combinations, and you can build very long structures based on this, and you have comparative structures, A is to B, S, C is to D. and rhythmic structures like poetry. Tap, heartbeat, taps. And if you put this together, you could argue that conversation, ordinary oral structures, are the basis of drama and theatre, the enriched literary forms of theatre. You could argue that phonological rhythm, assonance, and rhyme are the centre of the poetic text, again, to be found in every culture. You could argue that narrative is the driving force propelling the fictional text from which we learn all these things about ourselves. And you could argue that oral performances, rich in metaphor, as we will see when we talk about the covered, covers all of this. It combines these so-called literary, high literary genres, but they are to be found in the oral forms, which is why I'm interested in the structural properties of oral forms. Robin Dunbar argues the same thing. He's written in 1996 and again in 2010, that moral codes are evolved and mental and emotional resources are evolved through social grooming, through oral conversation. So orality, I'm arguing, we all have argued, are quite important. And today, literary Darwinists say it's impossible to fully understand and appreciate a literary text unless you keep in mind that humans behave in universal yet culturally specific ways. And the most effective and truest works of literature are those which exemplify the truths about human nature. So these are some of the background. Now I come to India. Now, India is very interesting because India has more scripts than I believe the rest of the world put together. We'll look at the situation. India also has, well, at least the Indian subcontinent, half the world's illiterate population today. So we confront a paradox. How is it that this country with a rich tradition of scripts has so much illiteracy? Jack Goody has a thesis. I won't tell you what that thesis is for now, but we will come to it. Okay, so this is the Brahmi. Now, if I just did it, I'm very bad at these arrows, so I, you know, but anyway, long and short of it, Indus Valley up there, we don't know much about it, we haven't deciphered it, we know Rosetta. The Brahmi, left to right, Indus Valley was boostrophied and Oxbla went one way, then the other way, then the other way. This one went right to left, and then this is the line we want to look at. Brahmi, Brahmi on the Ashokan inscriptions and the prototypes. Scripts of northern India. Most of the medium is stone. We have eight scripts, around eight, that we find around India. And then you find other scripts, the Siddhamatrika, the Grantha, which was mainly in the southern part of India. And this is the modern script that we use now. So the mediums are palm leaf paper. And this has remained more or less stable for the past 15 centuries. Okay, so that's a map, language map of India. These are some of the languages of India, and just some. So India has one-sixth of the world's population, as many of you will know, and one-sixth of the world's languages, according to the Guinness Book of Records, if you trust the Guinness Book of Records. These are the major scripts. Bengali, Gujarati, Kannada, Malayalam, Marathi, and these have had political consequences. In addition, you have English as well. The scripts, one script, Ashokan Brahmi, spread to Sri Lanka. It's part of the Balinese script, the thing. So you can see there's a lot of script dominance, and each of these script users have 50,000, 50 million, 60 million people using the script, in many cases more. So script is very dominant. And people have said, modern linguists, such as Pattanayak, that scripts are religiously are significant, and even though scripts are no more permanent than fashions and clothes, but they mean something. Writing was about, had magical powers, etc. This is a script map. So Indians will make script maps because scripts are so critical. Okay, so now, side by side, of course, we have all these oral texts, and I've tried to date them. We have the Vedas, the Mahabharata, the Ramayans, the Bhakti poets, we have Dastans, the Baramasas, which describe all 12 months of the year, we have regional folk tales. So they are all kind of jammed together in one kind of universe. All these oral texts. So when people came to India, so I'm quoting to you from Al-Biruni, and Al-Biruni was in the 11th century. Okay, so he says, these Indians, I don't understand them. They write one thing, and then when you go and check the pronunciation somewhere else, they say something else. And the reason for this is interesting, because this is the time the scripts, according to me, were breaking up. So it looked the same, but they weren't the same. So, you know, so you kind of find accounts and accounts of the linguistic and script things going together, you know, sort of confusing the issue. And Akbar found so much thing. And you know, the date is given. So it says 9th of August 1582, and Colin Blakemore quotes this as well. I knew this text. And he says he locked up some kids. We aren't allowed to do this kind of experiment anymore. But he locked up the people and he said, look, I'm keeping an eye on the time. So I have half an hour, roughly. Okay. So he said, you know, let's find out what the original language really is. And this is an experiment you find reported again and again. So we don't know whether this was really done with Akbar. But I trust Abul Fazl, because Abul Fazl documents each day very, very carefully. So, and he says that he was very disappointed because when he deprived the children of wet nurses, they came out with no language. It was the language of the... So you can see that India has been the ground of experimentation with script and speech for a long time. The Brits, I will not talk about the Brits for today. Okay, but the conflict between the written and the oral was skipped. Came into our linguistic policy and also into self-perceptions of individual Indians. So Kamla Das says, I'm Indian, very brown, I speak three languages, write in two, dream in one. And this is taught in every school in India. And this one, since we come from an oral tradition, I found this in the paper just before I came, this paper, this is my proof. So it says, this is a guilt perception. Since we come from an oral tradition, preserving the past doesn't matter to us, and we do not deserve our classics. So this idea that orality has done us harm is a very deeply embedded self-perception which we have to deal with. So now I come to the second part, which is more exciting in a way. So this is about the cupboard, and you know, many Indians will know that the cupboard opens like this, and I'll pass it around. And it opens and opens and opens, and everything has a door. So this is a Shukla Paksh, and then there is a Shyam Paksh. Shukla is the sun and the moon sides, and each of them has a story, and the doors open. We can pass this around. And it opens both arms, as you will be able to see. And if you go inward, you keep opening the doors, and right at the end, you will find the darshan. So, you know, you'll find the gods right at the end, inside here. Another door. So you keep opening the doors, and you find. And so there's a lot of suspense. And, you know, Borges of the Garden of the Four King Paths, when you have it here. You have all these postmodern things. This way, that way, story can go here, story can go there, you can close the cupboard. So for me, these are not children's devices. They are very, very sophisticated storytelling techniques which the cupboard but the teller can extract. The real cupboards are very big, so everybody sits around. These are small ones. So there's Krishna at the bottom of the cupboard, the one you saw. There he is inside. So how did he get inside? So he was outside, you know. So see, he's outside. Now he's inside. Then you see the cars. And that's no ordinary cow, because that's the Kamadhenu. That's the Dhenu, the one who grants the wishes. And this is the Kalpataru, the wish-granting tree. It's very sophisticated, and you can take it all apart. So you can see every bit separate and together. Now, I think these are sophisticated in the extreme, and that you can have any postmodern theory of narrative, and you can get there. Okay, so these are other versions of cupboards. There's Krishna inside, there's Hanumanji outside, and there's the sun, you know. Everything is being watched, the whole Leela, the whole play. And this is from Orissa. And that's a cupboard here. They carry the cupboards all the way up to immerse them and to Haridwar and other places. And that's Durga in Bengal. And she has the face of an Indian film actress, Hema Malini's face, Bollywood actress. And then, of course, we have these ones. Have you seen these? They're very good. Mm-hmm. So we've got this, we've got, and death. And all of them, and they're very sturdy, so you can carry them all over the world. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I asked, why did you choose these? And he said, the design of life is such that you have these characters. The design, he used the English word design for this. And actually I looked at the Pottachitra in Orissa, and what you find is each of these round holes fold three ways. So, I forgot to bring one of those. You can turn it three ways, the palm leaf, and you will see the first one is an innocent looking beast, and then there is a love-making couple, and then there is a very serene God. So is this telling us something about, again, it's not just any old way, all the avatars are there, and they are all based on forms of life, on nature's forms of life. So, I got interested in the fact that there was so much material culture, and that it was making inroads into urban society. So I might come and meet Mark and give him, one of these. So I would be buying it and giving it to him as a present, but it would be made somewhere else with this whole orality thing wrapped around it. So it was really important for me. So, to investigate this. And I would say that there's a lot of interchange going on, linguistic and materially, and in terms of economics in these cultures. So we see the girl reading. I have one here. It's somewhere. The third section, just to hurry on a little bit, because I want to leave time for talking, is I want to talk about today's culture and the kind of students I teach at the IIT. Now, IIT has students who are mathematically very gifted, and they can do differential equations and program machines and do IT. They get hired by Google very often. So what is happening? What do these students have to do with the cupboard, I ask myself? Is all this oral business and this preservation and all this completely irrelevant to them? And I thought about this a lot, and I thought about, how we'd inherited all these bureaucratic cultures from the British, all this writing cultures, the Babu cultures. And then I asked, how is it, we are in the middle of a technological revolution. The top of India is certainly in this revolution. So how can we understand us, these two ends of Indian culture, which are also two ends of world culture? And I began because I'm quite a physical, I'm interested in materiality. And I noticed that writing required the dextrous, what is called the dextrous grip, the thumb and forefinger grip. So when you hear about the monkey typing on something, on a typewriter, it's always a monkey on a typewriter who will produce Shakespeare in 1,000 tries. It's never the monkey with the dexterous gift, because apes don't have that grip. However, this grip is changing because of lateralization. We're using both hands. You have changes in handedness. We're right-handed for dexterity. We also choose characters from an array on the thing without having to form the characters with our hands. So we have changes, perceptual changes. We used to write like this. Now the computer screen is like this. There's been a complete change in embodiment in who we are. And information, obviously, computers give us memory access and all of this. So it's as if there have been, we are in the middle of a set of cueings which are quite close to the covert and to the oral culture. So I ask myself, look, if we have, we are in the technological revolution, what has it done for our literary forms, for our culture? So, and we see we have emails, chat rooms, video games, narrative, vlogs, SMSs, whatever. And I looked at the figures. And what you find is that whether you're looking at the Mehrabian Index, which was based on how human beings talk face to face, and you look at Twitter, most of the time we are engaging in what's called phatic communion. We are not really producing information in the straight and narrow sense. We are talking our way through information. In other words, we are creating little stories. So if you now look at India's youth, the median age of the entire population of 1 billion is supposed to be 25 years. So even if it's 30, it's a very young population, very young, able to change its embodied forms. Okay, so these are my students, and this thing struck me that, hey, I thought they could only use this, but really they are experienced users, or they are aligned to the ways of the covert. They are combining orality and literacy in very new ways. So these guys, this is their covert. But it is, covered means the story box. This is their story box. But they certainly are attached to a story box. And when I try, I've done lots of work with them now. And they're very interested in the story box. Why? Because they've had no, they listened to these oral stories from their mothers when they were young. They didn't read any literature. And now they're in college and they can do all this technical stuff. So for them, the covered is real. The covered is something they can turn into a video game. The covered is something they can use for self-understanding. So these technology brats are really quite connected to the oral traditions, to my surprise. And I did a lexical test. And what I did a thing for a Cambridge University Press book called Language in South Asia. And what I found is they're mixing their languages. Completely, 50% Hindi words, 50% or English words, and they have lost their reverence for the English language spoken perfectly, and they want to speak other forms of language, which they call Bakra and Bakwas. They code switch all the times, and they recognize that code switching is not only a matter of mixing languages, but also mixing forms, the oral and the written. So I've done lots and lots of stuff with clippings and this and that, but they keep changing. So if you look at Funda, is a clipping from Fundamental, and Funday is a Hindi ending. it's a plural ending from Hindi. So there's lots of stuff going on, which I won't take you into the technicalities, but you can see this is happening in advertising discourse. It's happening in using Hindi and English all the time side by side. And so we find that the elements which we had kept separately of writing and speech are coming together and becoming a kind of oral literate form. So that this form is very good for looking at psychological development as well as technically how oral forms come into literacy, which is why I think India is a good hunting ground for linguists. Mm. So phatic, this is phatic communion. People are talking all the time on Twitter, on Think, or say, and they are mixing languages, they're mixing forms, and so you know, you could say, just now I don't want you to look at the bottom. They have vague topics, code switching, so I've done lots of coding of this stuff on a large corpus. Repetitions, misspellings, meta-representations of speech, laughter, you know, emoticons, puns, all this sort of stuff. You have lots of representation of emotional states, use of endearments, often covert behaviors, changes of gender. You know, this is very, it's speech made oral. And you see it all the time. And so for them, it's not such a shock when we talk about the covered, the oral traditions and so on. They want to preserve this stuff. They think this is great. You know, so this is, this I found very interesting. Locatives, deixis, there's that, you know, all the things you associate with face to face, you find it. So, you know, in a way, we have found a breaking through of, this is in my more kind of optimistic moments. Mm-hmm. I think we have found new freedoms. But only in my optimistic moments. We find lots of self-confidence, bilingualism, so there's no longer a source language, a target language. These guys know both languages, but they choose to mix. The attitudes towards English have changed. A very big topic. Youth as a locus of power is being established because it's a very young country and there's all the psychological struggle for your own space. There's a lot of self-understanding. So this is this arena, the arena of technologies, digitization and so on, is also an arena for understanding our traditions and our traditional cultures. So a lot of reflexivity. One language is used to comment on another language, Hindi commenting on English, and so on and so forth. And lots of diasporic effects. So lots of people are migrating in India, all over, from the small towns, villages, to the cities, and from India to England, America, and all these Western countries, and elsewhere. And so there is, they are carrying their language with them, like backpackers. And that's quite interesting. So we're traveling and talking, walking, talking is being repeated. And so I would plead that we should have notes towards a new vocabulary for understanding this conjunction of the traditional cultures and all these wonderful, you know, objects and how they are fantasized into virtual reality inside the screen. And the new covers, what you would call it, is the new covered. So this is the text of the covered, which we try to read. It's a very complicated text, and what I would have really liked to do, and I'm doing now, is to make a narrative map of India with the people who own the covers, their performative traditions, and so on, and put them in contact with people like the IIT guys, and see how they talk, and they do talk. They talk wonderfully to each other. So I think I'm doing okay. I thought, the thing is that I write poetry. And many people say to me, like you said, oh, you're a poet. And poets are supposed to be these really strange creatures who don't... you know, who can't connect and who is in some elevated space. But I think of poetry as very much part of the basic rhythmic uses of language and text. So I thought I'd end with a poem for 2 minutes. Is that okay? And I thought I'd choose... I have two poems. One is one I wrote when I was 25, or 24. So this was the same age as my students are now. And then I just came to Cambridge. And it brings in all these issues, how confused you are at that age, but how also how adventurous and how you have to confront your lying self and your cultural conflicts. So I wanted to be... At Cambridge I learned... So I'm 24, so you'll have to forgive me. At Cambridge I learned to lie with elegance, to turn to advantage a narrow bed, a narrower scholarship. Sail close to the edge of fence, but be careful not to sink. Fence myself with books, but be careful not to think. I thrust behind the lowered guards of several visit duns, merry made through every night and blackmailed in the mornings. A soupçon of malice saw me to success. I learned to trade more and more, forever less and less. And now I am a don myself, I wasn't of course, whose duty is to see the shuffling undergraduates develop deviously, sharp their skill at feinting, secure a neat pass or two, but above all forget those clumsy truths that send them far, far beyond the edge. A Queen Anne bed, a unique dresser, I teach my acolytes finesse and pleasure. For the untutored minute comes, the cold fence circling wait. Sticks word slip are familiar quarters, point encompasses point, and there's an end to all our hauteur. And I think that in a way, you know, stories and having children keeps you humble. Above all, you are humble because you know that there's so many things there and you just don't know them. And I wanted to tell you about this poem, which was Stephen Hawking, who was also another Cambridge person. He came to India and he said, you know, you have all these myths and legends and this and that and, you know, astrology and whatnot. And he said, I don't, because they gave him a dancing Shiva. You know, there's the Shiva dancing on the ocean. And he says, I don't understand this. What is it? And he said to me, you know, very smart he is. So he said, what is it? So, and he types this stuff. So I said, and I couldn't find how to explain our myths and legends, our dancing Shiva to him. So I said, and then I read in the papers that they had taken him to the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, and they were spinning him round and round in his chair so that he could dance to Punjabi rap. So then I said, so I wrote him this poem, which he acknowledged. So he said, Shiva knows no Bhangra, no the Punjabi rap, but he's a divine dancer who never takes a nap. And if for the single trillionth of the second Shiva ceased to dance, all the world's great cities would shiver on a knife edge of chance. Every star in the universe would cease to burn. Neither sun nor earth would turn. Matter grows so dense, so intense the dark, so you can see the black hole structure, so intense the dark that your cry would die on a windless night in the lap of the sea. When Shiva sleeps, you will know eternity. So that's what our covert has taught me. So there you are. Okay, thank you.